This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
In this case, it's clear that the respondents are the ones in charge of security in this country. They are, in effect, in charge of execution of warrants of arrest. They have clearly shown that they have no respect for the rule of law and will not comply with the orders of this court.
That's Judge Odunga issuing his sentence on three Kenyan officials for defying an order to release opposition leader Miguna Miguna. Details next. Also, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi got the landslide victory he wanted as a mandate heading into his second term. And the United States, European Union, and several Western embassies have expressed concern over political violence in Tanzania. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Kenya's High Court has fined three top government officials $2,000 each for defying court orders, including an order to release detained opposition leader Miguna Miguna. The sentence reflects a months-long tug of war between the executive branch and the judiciary in the wake of last year's contentious presidential election. Rael Ombor has the latest from Nairobi.
Kenyan Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i, Inspector General of Police Joseph Boynet, and the head of immigration Godard Kihalangwa were again no-shows in court Thursday.
Each of the first, second, and third respondents are hereby penalized to pay a fine of Kenya shillings 200,000 personally. The said sum will be deducted directly from their next month's salaries.
Judge George Odunga issued the sentence. On Wednesday, the judge held the three officials in contempt of court for defying an order to immediately release opposition leader Miguna Miguna, who had been detained at the airport since Monday and denied entry to Kenya.
In this case, it's clear that the respondents are the ones in charge of security in this country. They are, in effect, in charge of execution of warrants of arrest. They have clearly shown that they have no respect for the rule of law and will not comply with the orders of this court. To my mind, even if the citizens were to arrest them, they'll still be placed at the disposal of their juniors. I do not see how any of their juniors will execute the warrants against them.
The Interior Ministry spokesman declined to comment on the sentencing when reached by VOA. Kenyans woke up Thursday morning to learn that Miguna had been deported for a second time during the night, this time to Dubai. A human rights lawyer and assistant to Miguna told VOA's Daybreak Africa that Miguna had been forcibly deported under sedation. Lawyers in Nairobi wore yellow ribbons Thursday in protest.
The legal fraternity and the whole country has become increasingly concerned with state's blatant disregard of lawful court orders as witnessed over the last couple of months. There can be no justification for disobedience of court orders by any party.
Harriet Chigai, the vice president of the Law Society of Kenya, spoke alongside leaders of the Kenya National Human Rights Commission at a joint press conference Thursday. Officials have defied several court orders this year relating to both the previous arrest and deportation of Miguna in February and a media blackout over the opposition swearing in of Raila Odinga as the so-called people's president in January. Miguna's lawyer Nelson Harvey says the government has set a dangerous precedent.
The biggest beneficiary of the due process is the government. So when the government disobeys court orders, they are setting a very bad precedent, because in future, nobody else will have any compulsion to obey a court order.
The matter is expected to return before the High Court on April 6. Setting the date for the hearing, Judge Odunga said his order from earlier this week that the state produce Miguna in court is still valid. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The head of a major opposition party in Tanzania and five party members are facing charges related to their alleged organization of an illegal protest last month. A student was killed during the demonstration, reportedly from a stray police bullet. The charges include inciting hatred and rebellion against the government. The situation has heightened concerns that President John Magufuli is cracking down on dissent. The government has denied it is restricting free expression. The arrests came Tuesday night, and the defendants, including four members of parliament, were denied bail. Abdallah Safari, Chadema's deputy chairman, held a news conference yesterday urging international intervention in what he called a terrifying situation. The United States, European Union, and several Western embassies have expressed concern over political violence and allegations of human rights abuses since Magufuli became president in late 2015. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi got the landslide victory he wanted as a mandate heading into his second term, but it wasn't as widespread as he hoped. State-owned newspapers projected today that el-Sisi got 92% of the vote. That's down from nearly 97% in 2014, a year after he took power in a military takeover amid mass protests. El-Sisi had only token opposition because the top candidates were either arrested or pulled out, leaving only one competitor who supported the president. The state-owned Al Haram newspaper reported 2 million ballots were disqualified because voters wrote in other names. The government pushed hard for a big turnout to bolster the electoral endorsement of el-Sisi's policies. But officials say turnout was only about 40% of the nearly 60 million registered voters, down from 47% 4 years ago. That's despite widespread reports of indictments like free food and a possible fine for not having a good reason to skip voting. Official results are expected on Monday. We could see the world's first 100 million population city by the end of the century. That is the conclusion of new research into the speed of urbanization in many fast-growing countries in Africa and Asia, which suggests even small cities could balloon into huge metropolises in the coming decades. Henry Ridgewell has more.
By the end of the century, the world's population is forecast to reach up to 14 billion. 80% of those people will be living in cities, according to the new research from the Ontario Institute of Technology. Co-author Professor Daniel Hornweg spoke to VOA via Skype.
We're now seeing the urbanization wave heading through China that's toward the latter part of its urbanization, and now it's headed for India. And then we'll see it culminate in the big cities of sub-Saharan Africa.
That could mean the first 100 million population city, and the top candidate is Lagos, Nigeria. Today, its population is 20 million, not the largest, as that accolade belongs to Tokyo, with about 38 million people, but one of the fastest growing. In two generations, Lagos has grown 100-fold. By 2100, it is projected to be home to more people than the entire state of California.
Well, Lagos, Dar es Salaam, Kinshasa, these are the cities that are looking at 4 to 5-fold increases in population. By the end of the century, the lion's share of large cities will be, you know, the top 20, if you will. Most of those will be in Africa.
Lagos sprawls across 1,000 square kilometres, an urban jungle of skyscrapers, shantytowns and everything in between. Its population grows by 900 people per day. The poorest residents, often migrant communities, live in slums by the lagoon. Amnesty International has warned of ruthless forced evictions to make way for new developments, which have left more than 30,000 people homeless and 11 dead. Oladipupo Avyomie lives in the Ilaje Bariga shantytown.
The threat of being evicted, the threat of being chased away overnight, has grabbed people to the extent that they cannot even walk, operate or do anything in this area.
Across Africa, the median age is under 20 and the fertility rate is 4.4 births per woman. Even small cities are forecast to balloon in size. Niamey in Niger could grow from less than 1 million today to 46 million by the end of the century. Blantyre in Malawi from 1 to 40 million. Asia too will witness huge urban growth, with Kabul in Afghanistan projected to hit 50 million people. Hornweg says despite the associated problems of slums, poor sanitation and pollution, increasing urbanization can be a good thing.
Cities, by their nature, because of our more compact lifestyle, can provide a quality of life higher than anywhere else with less energy per unit of GDP. So cities actually provide a really important opportunity. We won't get to global sustainability without big cities.
Many cities in the West are predicted to plateau or decline in size. By the end of the century, only 14 of the biggest 100 are forecast to be in North America or Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Sixteen past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Thousands of school children in rural South Africa must use pit toilets at school. These informal latrines are undignified and can be deadly. Recently, a five-year-old girl drowned in a pit latrine in the Eastern Cape. Nearly a year ago, a little boy died the same way. These deaths have angered President Cyril Ramaphosa, who's ordered his basic education minister to compile an audit on school toilet facilities. From Johannesburg, Nadia Same has the story.
A flushing enclosed toilet. It's something people in many parts of the world take for granted. But in 9,000 schools in South Africa, pit toilets are still in use. In about 4,000 schools, pit latrines are the only option. That means children are forced to relieve themselves by squatting over dangerous unsanitary holes. Section 27, a public interest law group, for years has urged education authorities to improve the situation. It even took the Department of Basic Education to court over the death of five-year-old Michael Komapi, who fell into a pit latrine at his school in Limpopo province in 2014. Tabang Po is a senior researcher with the group.
We have had various undertakings by them, none of which have come to fruition, including the fact that there is a policy called the Nonsense Standards for School Infrastructure, which said that pit toilets would be eradicated by 2016. That deadline came and went, and facilities are still unsafe. And so we hope that this, within these 3 months, a proper audit will take place.
The lobby group says education authorities are violating pupils' rights by failing to provide proper sanitation facilities. The education department now says that given its budget, pit toilets won't be eradicated until 2025. But President Cyril Ramaphosa and frustrated parents and schools are not accepting that. The president wants a full audit on school toilets and a cost plan to improve unsatisfactory facilities within 3 months. Troy Martins is the spokesperson for the Basic Education Department.
So we essentially want to bring the timelines that we have and the plans that we have forward quite dramatically. And in order to do that, we might need to relook at some of our projects that are currently funded and look at restructuring our budget to accommodate this plan. Or we may need to work closely with Treasury to see if it's possible for us to get new money to fund this quite extensive project.
Within days of President Ramaphosa's directive, Basic Education Minister Angie Motshekga convened a meeting of provincial education heads to tackle the problem. Martin says the national department needs the help of provincial education officers to make a difference.
So essentially, education is a concurrent function, which means that a lot of the on-the-ground work happens at a provincial level. For example, infrastructure, which is what the provision of sanitation was for under, is a provincial competency. So in order to basically deliver on the president's directive, We need to get the support of provinces and come and work together with provinces in order to support them.
While South African education officials put their heads together and juggle the numbers, thousands of students in rural areas continue to brave perilous toilets, and the family of 5-year-old Lumka Mketwa must come to terms with the fact that she died this month in the latrine at her school in the Eastern Cape. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
Orphans who study at the Malawi Charity's free schools are learning to make prosthetic limbs. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre about the Jacaranda Foundation's program.
Trainer Robert Buck has been doing vocational skills training at the Jacaranda Foundation for 15 years. Earlier programs included making friendship bracelets and small moccasins for orphaned babies.
So on this journey, I decided to try this new project with the prosthetic hands. I myself have done this activity with a bunch of teachers when I used to live in Shanghai. And I thought it would be a fantastic project to do with students.
The students were selected to assemble their prosthetic hands using plastic parts, springs, screws and metal pieces. A U.S. company, Odyssey Prosthetics and Orthotics, supplies the materials.
Once we finish building them, we now send them back to the company in California, who will check them over to make sure that everything is done properly, and then they will be in charge of sending them out to children around the world who have lost a limb, either from landmines or an accident, or maybe they were born with only one hand.
About 400 children attended the Jacaranda School, which started in 2002. Most either have no parents or parents who could not care for them. Marie Da Silva is the founder of the Jacaranda Foundation.
What this project is going to do is that it shows our students here that though we are being given this help over here, we too can give other people help. So it's very important for our children to be able to give, to be able to think about helping.
Christopher Jabwa is one of the students working on the prosthetics.
I've assembled two hands. Most of the times when I see people without hands, I feel sorry. But with this, I think people have new hands, so it was very nice to me. I feel like I'm helping someone whom I cannot see, which is so nice.
The foundation plans to soon open a new free vocational school, which will teach skills such as carpentry, hairdressing, painting, and tailoring. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The U.S. ambassador to Kenya is preparing to say goodbye after President Donald Trump nominated his successor. In a statement, Robert Godek touted progress in a number of areas of cooperation. In particular, he says, the U.S. helped put books in the hands of every primary school student in Kenya and has kept a million HIV-positive residents stay healthy with antiretroviral treatment. A career diplomat, Godek was appointed to the position in January 2013 by former President Barack Obama. Before that, he was ambassador to neighboring Tanzania for 3 years. Trump has nominated Illinois State Senate Kyle MacArthur to replace Godek in Nairobi. Cell phones and even smartphones are now used by millions of Africans, from the poor to the wealthy, in cities and tiny villages. In South Africa, mobiles and social media connect so many people that an organization is using the technology to advance human rights. Amundala.mobi is a phone-based platform that links people around issues such as crime. It builds resources to drive campaigns and spread information. Darren Taylor reports about how technology is working for South Africans.
Workers protest against what they call the dumping of cheap chicken from Europe onto the South African market. They say the imports are destroying the country's poultry industry, resulting in the loss of thousands of jobs. This is just one of the many issues that Amundla.mobi has raised voices against. using the communication made possible by cell phones.
Yes, yes, thank you so much. No problem. Okay, bye, bye.
In 2012, the police were advancing on the informal settlement where Koketso Mueti lived to evict her and other residents. But the authorities hadn't bargained on her fighting back using her smartphone.
Suddenly I had internet access, so started a blog as well, started writing about what was happening. I could deploy bulk SMSs to tell neighboring communities to shut down their roads when we were protesting so that police couldn't reach us. It was just this one device that enabled a much bigger world.
Using her phone, Mueti turned public opinion against the evictions. The state bowed and didn't remove poor people from their homes. The success made Mueti think of using mobile networks to unite people to oppose injustice.
Amandla.mobi is a community of over 128,000 people who are working to turn every cell phone into a democracy building tool. We do this so that no matter where you live, what language you speak, you are able to take action on issues affecting your life.
Amandla is a term that means power to the people. Mueti says her movement tries to empower the powerless, with a focus on a particular segment of the population.
Black women from low-income communities disproportionately bear the brunt of any injustice in this country.
So this stuff will not leak.
Schoolgirls laugh in a classroom as one of their fellow pupils demonstrates how she uses a pair of thick socks as sanitary pads to an Amandla.mobi activist.
So you guys said you use socks, and what else do you use for your period, for your menstruation? Tissue. And newspaper.
The girls are so poor that they can't afford sanitary pads and must use other means to prevent embarrassment. Amandla.mobi has launched a campaign for the state to provide free sanitary pads at schools across the country. Ahead of the South African Finance Minister's budget announcement every February, the Treasury asks citizens to suggest what it should spend on.
The call that's made is made only in English. It's accessible only to those who are able to access the internet. So what we did is we took the Treasury form and made it mobile friendly so people could fill in their recommendations, their suggestions.
Like most Amandla.mobi campaigns, the project was run in all 9 official South African languages. Mueti says her organization has made enemies.
The most vile encounters that we've had have been particularly with corporates and with racists, right?
She says she's lost count of how many times she's been threatened, especially by big companies, after they've mistreated workers.
Corporates in particular know that they have much more resources than an organization like ours. So for them to even suggest just lawsuits and things like that, there's an assumption that you are going to back down because you don't have as much resources.
Mueti has no doubt that Amandla.mobi will have lots of campaigns to mobilize in 2018, with the ruling African National Congress split and rising complaints about deteriorating public services. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wycheck Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.